This podcast is a quest for well-being, a quest for a meaningful life through the exploration of fundamental truth. Enlightening ideas, insights on physical, mental, and spiritual health. The inspiration is love. The aspiration is to awaken new ways of thinking that can lead us to a new way of being. Being well. Welcome to Body, Mind, and Soul Healing Conversations.
Carl Rogers, psychologist, wrote in 1959 his view on human nature, that when people are placed in meaningful therapeutic conditions, they will naturally change in a positive direction. Carl Rogers and William Miller, psychologist, have separately shared that this tendency toward reaching your true inner self, it is as natural as a plant's growth upward toward the light when given adequate soil, water, and sunshine. It is as if each person has a natural mature end state or purpose, telos in Greek, toward which he or she will grow given optimal conditions. They say that the telos of an acorn is to become an oak tree, to reach its true purpose. Each action we take as humans is directed towards some telos, i.e. purpose, and real change involves identifying concrete steps needed to attain telos. Telos has many terms that describes it in philosophy: goal, completion, or fulfillment. This translates into all walks of life. Valeria interviews Marissa Harris. She is a compassionate therapist dedicated to guiding individuals on a transformative journey toward holistic well-being through sensory motor psychotherapy. She is a licensed independent clinical social worker, national board certified clinical social worker diplomat, certified substance abuse provider, and certified in mindfulness-based relapse prevention, and a mindfulness-based relapse prevention group facilitator. She has specialized training in trauma-informed approaches in level 2 sensory motor psychotherapy, trauma-informed stabilization treatment, EMDR, motivational interviewing, and internal family systems approach. She is also trained in the Institute of Functional Medicine, where she explores ways to highlight the intricate link between our emotional experiences and bodily responses. She is currently the owner of Telos Health and Wellness Services, a private practice where she offers individual therapy as well as consultation. Throughout her 25 years in the field, she has served as a steadfast advocate and mentor, guiding and empowering a team of dedicated trauma, medical, and forensic professionals. She shares the honor and privilege of supporting individuals navigating life circumstances that have led to symptoms consistent with PTSD or dissociative disorders. Her focus remains centered on the person and understanding the unique challenges someone could face as a result of their experiences or environment. Exploring a holistic approach, she believes in the power of the body to hold and release emotional pain, trauma, and stress. Through gentle exploration and mindfulness, she helps people reconnect with the innate wisdom of their body at a pace that works for the person she is supporting. She feels that the body tells a story, and she utilizes a way of listening, honoring, and understanding its language. Meet Marissa at ELOSHealthandWellnessServices.com. Here's the interview with Marissa Harris.
In your own words, who is Marissa Harris?
Wow. In this moment, I would, I guess, define myself as a compassionate, balanced individual, really deeply grounded in my roles as not just a therapist, but really I nurture my presence, goes beyond that to encompass my roles as a mother, wife, caregiver, sister, friend. And I'm just really helping people find joy in their life. Mm-hmm. and reclaiming their own agency. Something I really have a lot of passion for.
Mm, how wonderful to hear that. Yeah, I did hear, I read about you. So I love the word compassionate to describe oneself. There is something about that word that the meaning of the word compassionate that makes me think about somebody who is in touch with the interconnectedness of life, how everything's it's connected, that we are not disconnected from the outside world and others. So that's beautiful. Another thing you said just now that caught my attention was I'm a balanced individual, you said. This word balance, I mean, that's another interesting concept. What does it feel like, Marisa, to be balanced? And is that a sort of a destination, per se, a goal to have in life? Or, I'm just wondering, what state of being, per se?
Yeah, such a great question. I guess balance could be a spectrum as well for other people. I think in my life, there's always that sense of balance kind of moves and shifts. And to me, I all see that as the experience of being human. But it also means that I am open to this idea of multi-consciousness within myself as well, just including with the people that I serve, that I have different parts of myself that interact in the world as well. And I spend a lot of time noticing that within myself and how I interact within the space with another person.
Yes. So it's not something that can be easily defined, right, in a way, because it's more multidimensional in a way. And the idea of balance. I always ask that question here. So you are a psychotherapist, founder of Telos, a health and wellness service. I read about the meaning of Telos, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. That's so interesting. I had to add this to the introduction of the episode, which is so interesting. So I'll mention that in a minute. But for now, my question for you is what made you to become a psychotherapist? What inspired you to make this choice?
Well, I think I have always known that I wanted to be a therapist, even at a really young age, and understanding the psychology of another individual, just being able to observe people in spaces. I don't know if it's an innate quality or something that I've learned along the way, but I just think that every single person has an experience that just needs to be guided. And so I've found different, of course, modalities and therapeutic spaces to help me be able to guide people, utilizing like kind of the anthropology of language, like how do we interact in the world and how language, when you're meeting with another person, can really help you be in space with them, and what different words mean to each person. So, it's just, there's so many experiences within that I've really enjoyed.
Right.
Wow.
That sounds very much, very spiritual to me, as I mentioned off record. And I often mention in all podcasts that I host how interested I am in spirituality. And I feel that there's a direct connection with psychology, because it is we are trying to find what the subject is. It's right. What is giving us this feeling that we are experiencing something that we call objective, you know, having an experience. And everyone seems to have a different way of feeling, of viewing, of perceiving reality. So that is just fascinates me. And it's incredible when we kind of meet people that we relate really well. We use language that it's just so close to the experiencing that we are having, the inner world experience. That to me, it's a gift. I, that's why I do this too, by the way, because wait a minute, we're speaking the same language, and it's not, it doesn't happen too often in the day-to-day living. So I'm not yet talked to, I think now it's another good time to ask you about Talos. What is, yeah, why did you choose that name? And I already have an idea, of course, because I read it, but for the audience, what is, what's the meaning of Talos?
I guess the idea of that is, how do we develop this purpose to connect ourselves to nature and like human experiences? And I guess there's probably some really philosophical great words that surround it, but for me, it just sort of helps people kind of normalize the human experience. Like, we all have some objective or aim or belongingness or connection with life. And that's sort of the experience behind that, that essentially that is what we all want, some sort of drive to seek connection with others and just explore our existence in the world. I don't know if that's the best way of describing it, but that's my thought process around it.
Course, that's, I read, I actually read a lot about it. And, but I like one section where, to me, that this is the closest to summarizing what it is. Hopefully I pronounced that correct. I keep saying the word, like Talos. So it said, on your website, it said, each person has a natural, mature end state of purpose toward which he or she will grow, given optimal conditions. And then you gave the, I think it, you were informed by a psychologist, Carl Rogers. So, and then he talks about the tree. So the example would be the seed that I have here of an oak tree that is, you know, the goal is to become the oak tree eventually. And that's such a beautiful example of that, because that's how exactly how I see humans. And then I often ask the question, I ask myself, I've been asking for years, what's the purpose of being here? What is, what am I doing here? First, who am I? And then what, you know, what's my purpose here? So the question for you is, what is, what do you feel is the purpose of the human experience as a whole?
Oh gosh, such a good question. Yeah, I mean, each person has so many different experiences within that. Like, and often it's usually shaped around our developmental and relational experiences. And it's so hard to say because each person has their own direction or aim. But I think that oftentimes people want to be loved. That's the biggest experience that I've known out of all these years that I've worked behind the words of every person that I've experienced in my entire career is for, to be seen and to be loved.
Wow. How beautiful. Yeah, it goes back to that. And, you know, I was reflecting about this idea of being seen. Because my studies, they're mostly, as I mentioned, they're spiritual, philosophical, spiritual. And now, from the last 15 years, I'm a student of Vedanta, which is this, it's a very deep spiritual philosophy from India. So it's a Hindu philosophy that has been here for thousands of years. So, and, you know, they talk a lot about this pure consciousness. That's basically, that's the absolute reality that holds all the other realities together, that they are not fully real per se. They're dreamlike. And then this idea of, and then they explain how, what's the reason to be here, that there's no really, there's no specific reason for this to be. It's just the nature of consciousness. It's to express itself in different ways and forms. So the seeing, I was thinking about seeing, I guess I was looking at my husband's eyes the other day, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm always like reflecting on these things. He doesn't even know, like, who are you? Who is it? And it's kind of funny. And then he has no idea that what's in my mind, but I'm looking at him and And you know, he looked at me just the other day, like 2 days ago, and in a way that was almost like, oh, you see me. And that kind of, the insight was, ah, so that's what it is. It's something that cannot be seen. Consciousness is invisible, so it will never, the only way it can be seen is through form, is through, right, these expressions of in nature, that we are nature, we are not even part of nature, we are nature. So it that's what came to me immediately, like, ah, so that's what it is. It wants to see itself. So it's kind of God seeing itself. And it's all it wants. And maybe the idea of love, it's actually an extension of that, you know, going a bit deeper in a sense of appreciation of what that form is like. It, even if it is not a perfect one, it's okay. So in a sense of unconditionally loving something that's not perfect, that it's impermanent, that we know it's will dissolve. So I don't know. Yeah, I just love going deeper in this stuff. Okay, this is not part of the topic. Let me move on because I will be talking forever. Do you want to make a comment? Is there anything?
I was just going to say that one of the things that I love about Carl Rogers, for example, is he talks about unconditional positive regard and that this the beauty of, you know, like you don't have to win me over or show me all these aspects of yourself for me to accept you. I just accept you wholeheartedly. And I think that is how I move throughout the world, especially, well, in my own personal life, but also in my professional life, that accepting every person for who they are and their experiences.
Yes. Wow. Yes. Yeah, that's highly spiritual to me. Yeah, the closer I get to these, the understanding of these, you know, how it works is just, that's it. That will be it. Of course, there's so many aspects that we can, right, talk about, but this is one of them for sure. It might be the fundamental one.
Yes, for sure.
Another open question before we talk about the topic of childhood sexual abuse and the role of structural dissociation as a survival mechanism. This is the main topic. But before that, I have to ask you this question too. How do you define mental health these days, Marisa?
Yeah, I think mental health to understand that is one of the things that I just help people understand is how our experiences or missing experiences have shaped that and to accept every aspect of mood experience as a part of you is telling a story in some way. And we see these experiences as a part of you, then we are able to accept all of our internal health. So I know that's more of a broad, maybe meta experience definition of that. But yeah, there's mental health is, it goes back to being a fluctuation, and fluctuations are important. Every emotion is important.
I love how you say that about the story. Yeah, it's telling a story, everything. It's actually a part of a story. And that makes me think about the ultimate goal of spiritual, let's say, knowledge or realization. That would be to drop the story or to know that that's just a story. Mm-hmm. Basically, to know that that's a story. I don't think we can drop the story. We could, in a sense, right, of just being aware that's not the whole truth. But yeah, it's just being aware that that's a story and that's okay. Mm-hmm. So, So let me see. Let's go back to the topic. I can talk forever about these things. Gosh.
Me too. Yes.
So the first question about the topic related to the topic, childhood sexual abuse and the role of structural dissociation as a survival mechanism, is exactly that. What defines childhood sexual abuse and what is structural dissociation? Marisa.
To define childhood sexual abuse really is talking about really kind of any sexual activity, behavior, or contact between an adult, older adolescent, and a child or adolescent. So it can take on different forms, but one of them is physical contact. such as touch or other forms of touch. And I know these are sensitive words, like penetration and fondling. These are specific words in relation to physical contact. And there's also a non-contact form of abuse, such as exposure to sexual acts, pornography, or voyeurism. And another aspect of that is also exploitive interactions, and that could be grooming, coercion, manipulation for sexual purposes. And there's a lot of experience around that, because when we think about grooming and like even the word parentification, which is taking on a child or adolescent, taking on the emotional health of the parent because they're unable to do that, those are the things that create emotional vulnerability in children. And then puts children in experiences in which boundaries are blurred. So there's a lot of discussion around that, but those are kind of just the really specific experiences around that, the definition of what childhood sexual abuse is.
Right. Of course, I relate to it, unfortunately, sadly, in a way. You didn't mention the word seduction. Is that included there somehow?
Yes, that is. Seduction is also exploitive interactions. And seduction is a part of the grooming process, which is typically how individuals try to build trust. They test boundaries. They might isolate the child, or they try to normalize sexual behavior in a way to desensitize the child to engage in the act that the individual is trying to take advantage of that child in.
Yes. I interviewed somebody long ago. It's been probably 2 years now. She was sexually abused, and she became a psychotherapist too. Mm-hmm. And she told the story. She wrote a book about it, and we talked here. I remember how beautiful she was, in a sense of kind of going back even to tell the story in the book. We didn't discuss details here. Well, I usually don't. And then, but she's so courageous, and she was so, not just mature, but she came to a point of, I would say, healing. She was healed. The way she talked about the subject, it's a very sensitive subject, being the one behind the story. And then she said something that I never forgotten, because I have seen that in my husband's family just recently, a couple of years ago too, where I mentioned to them immediately too. She said, one of the things, because I was asking for the signs, what are the signs of when family member, what signs family members should be looking for, you know, around children, and then that are being sexually abused. And she said, one of the things that seems to be very normal, and it's not, is asking children to kiss or to go close to people just because they are part of the family and they are coming in the house. Yes. And then you say, oh, go give Uncle John a kiss. So that, she said, is unacceptable. That should not happen, because now you're creating this almost an invitation for the child to do that. But we need to ask children if that's what they want to do. How do you feel about Uncle John? So that really was something that it stayed with me. I never really forgotten that part of our conversation as a reference, because that happened a lot to me. And I see that with some children, and especially girls in my family. I see that they still do that. Oh, you know, give him a hug. And it never felt right. But then after talking to her, it's really now. I'm the first one to say something if I see that within any family gatherings or situation. So is that something that you came across, you're familiar with?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That it essentially, what it does is it blurs the boundaries of consent.
Yes.
And so if a child is told, you have to kiss this family member, or this is required of you, or sometimes this isn't even stated. It says, don't you want to do that? Mm, so then it sort of makes the child forget about their own internal messaging, which typically is, I don't want to do that. So then if their parent is telling them that you need to do this with family or even do that with the parent, it does make the child feel that if you are allowing this to happen, then how am I going to bring to you this other thing that is happening? So yeah, it really makes children, it puts children in a difficult experience of what consent means to them.
Confusion, right, Marisa?
Yes, a lot of confusion. Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah.
Gosh.
Yes.
So then the question, the other question I asked was, is structured dissociation what that is?
Yeah. Yeah, so really what structural dissociation is it's sort of this, like we were talking about earlier, multi-consciousness or different dissociative parts have different distinct functions. So essentially structural dissociation is the mind, they say that the mind is not a single unified entity and that rather it's composed of multiple dissociative parts, or sometimes they refer to them as ego states. Mm-hmm. And each part has distinct functions, memories, and ways of experiencing the world. And so when something happens to a child, there's this part of us that goes on with normal life, or what they kind of say is like the left part of the brain. And then there's the emotional part of the brain, which typically refers to around the right side of the brain. And so the part that goes on with normal life is the part that does the day-to-day functioning and interacts with the external world. And it holds back the traumatic memories and intense emotions and operates outside of the conscious awareness of the emotional part of the memory, or what they call implicit memory and explicit memory. And so how we function in that is the body, when you experience a traumatic incident, and let's say it's chronic, the body has to compartmentalize these traumatic experiences and the associated emotions, basically to preserve the ability to function, to be able to tolerate the individual in their everyday space, whoever is abusing them, if it's family or outside. And then it helps them be able to continue on with daily life. Wow. And there's a lot of different things around that I can go really deeply into, but you tell me where, how far. Yeah.
Wow. Yes, I'd love for you to go as far as you could. But one thing that caught my attention is that how the brain works, the body works. Mm-hmm. It seems like it's always trying to protect us in a way, right? That happens with them.
Yes.
They call it, suppression, repression, isn't it? Because there's a difference between repression and suppression. Mm-hmm. So I interviewed somebody about that recently, and he said that the Holocaust, he has a lot of clients who had been, would have in their families, Holocaust survivors, and he saw a pattern of having hypertension. Most of them developed this problem. And then he just, that was his conclusion, that that's because they were repressing the brain, those feelings. And then now, but it doesn't go away, right, Marisa? And maybe that's what I'm seeing that clearly, that the body does what it can in the moment, but then it's still there. It doesn't go anywhere.
Yes, it's coming back. Absolutely.
So yeah, please, if you could give me and the audience a little bit more of a, let's say, a relatable way to understand structured dissociation, perhaps through examples, as you just did, but more, perhaps more, let's say more relatable in the case of stress, anxiety, I don't know, somehow that we can try to understand this clearly.
Absolutely. Yeah. And before that, I just want to throw in something and this will I'll go into this in depth with a detail or an explanation or an example. Okay. So anytime all experiences that we have are remembered implicitly, but they're not all encoded in our body as like a narrative message or memory. Right. So oftentimes we're left with these implicit memories in the body. So for example, let's say somebody's missing experiences was they did not have the ability to be vulnerable or real in their life. Like they couldn't have like mutual relationships, let's say, or genuine mutual relationships. And let's say that person it wasn't safe to outwardly express that. So maybe we would refer to that person as an internalizer. So everything stays inside. Right. So some of the belief systems that might get created out of that is it's not okay to be safe or authentic. Mm. I need to stay in control all the time. People use my weaknesses against me. These are the beliefs that get formulated during that. Mm. So then we might have, or what memory would say they call procedural memory. So then our body remembers there are certain habits that are created because they weren't able to be vulnerable or real in these general mutual relationships. So they have a tendency, these somatic patterns might be, I need to really breathe just from my chest. So I get a lot of anxiety. I have a high, like I mobilize upward. I feel really ungrounded. And so I have to stay in control. I have to keep my power. I have to conceal all my weaknesses and vulnerability to avoid being exploited again. And so I help them understand that the purpose of that somatic pattern, let's say, is helping, you have to stay upward, like you have to keep going to be strong and invulnerable. And so I help them individuals understand that this is also a superpower. It makes good leaders generous. They can manage people under control. They're really cool under fire. So these individuals have to be one up. They have to be able to be able to seek respect because they've never been able to have that in their life. So that's an example. There's much more ways to go into that. But
yes, wow. I can think about myself in the past.
Yeah.
Doing exactly that and people around me, of course. Yeah, family members, too, if I know. And you know, Marisa, and I usually go to big pictures. Has been, for some reason, very interested in, you know, what's the big picture of this? You know, how did this came to be? What is, like I said to you off record, my main questions before used to be, who am I and what am I doing here? And then it kind of evolved into suffering, you know. First of all, why do we suffer and all this, how do we make sense of suffering? And then unnecessary suffering, kind of narrowed down to, because suffering seems to be unavoidable. So let me focus on unnecessary suffering. And for me, it has always been seeing the big picture. So the big picture of this, which we call life, that has to do something with freedom, then goes back to freedom again, as I mentioned off record, because my orientation for some reason is spiritual. So if this is, I'm wondering if this is a consciousness of what the experience we're having here as humans. If suffering, it's unavoidable. So this is something that we cannot do anything about it because part of the experience of being a human. But what about unnecessary suffering? What can we do about it? And then the answer for me has been finding inner peace, which has to do with the realization that I'm already free. So there's no really, it will be almost a waste of life if I keep trying to find freedom out there somehow. Oh, maybe when my circumstances get better, or when, you know, if I think about a moment in time when I get older, when, you know, I don't have so much work to do or whatever it is. So that all ended about, I would say 10 years ago. So the sinking kind of ended. And then now it's almost like a dance within the space of freedom, kind of being able to accept and be and gracefully dance that dance of being here and go through all of it without trying to push anything away. So, and I know that your work has to do with the exploration, investigation of that dance. And for, but I think the sad thing for some people, hopefully not too many people, most people, is that they're still trying to find a way out of it by going outside. It seems always out, getting out of it, but looking outside. And spirituality to me, it's the opposite. It's kind of almost like doing a, it's returning, kind of, let's see if I can put that in words. Just to look, always to look forward, right? Like the way we walk, everything's, we never really, most of the time, we don't question what is looking at the eyes, what is behind the eyes, what is aware of all this, because it seems like whatever is aware of all the experience is not really the experience. It's just aware of it, but it's not the experience. So that's when everything changes. So do you, I guess the question is, I know we have a lot of outlines here within the topic, but I have to ask you this question. So do you talk to your clients? Is this something that you kind of bring into your work somehow, the spiritual aspect of being a human?
Yeah, I think part of that comes from, I guess, normalizing our defensive experiences of every human and every mammal. And when we look at it in that aspect, so if we look at it from these particular, there's five different defense responses, and if we can see who they are, what part of these defensive responses, we know them as fight, we know them as flight, we know them as freeze, we know them as submission, and we know them as attach, cry. And each one of those has a purpose for every single individual, including mammals. And so when we start to recognize that what we might see them as destructive, let's say, they never are. It might get in the way in your life, but if we look at that, I always pose the question of how has that helped you survive? Right. How has that particular response helped you survive? And when we see it in that way, then we no longer feel that our body is against us. We feel that our body is connected to us and that it will never betray us ever. And so when we see that and we see these protective qualities, we start to notice what is me now and what memory of me then is coming now. And then we start to maybe even look at the younger child within us and see the vulnerability that is coming now. What is triggering the then to the now?
Right. Yes. That's really beautiful, though, that way of seeing, if one can understand that, how it works, that there's nothing against us, working against us. It's actually trying to help somehow. It's a matter of perception, right, Marisa, of understanding. So true. This is another, interesting idea, too, because I thought that if I went deep enough into the realization, the spiritual realization in knowledge, then nothing else will be needed. I'll be just like, oh, great. Not really. So going back to science, which to me is not apart from spirituality again, but it's, you know, this other aspect. It's another way of seeing the world, of perceiving the world, of understanding. It really is. But it's the same thing. It's just a different way of seeing, different lens. So yes, the work of not pushing anything away and just kind of is the work of acceptance, really, which has to me to do with inner peace. So I always mm-hmm. go back to that. It's almost like knowing the way home, the way back, going out in the forest and having mm-hmm. a lot of fun,
yeah.
getting lost, and then uh-huh. the knowing uh-huh. how to come back home. So uh-huh. there's something to do with that. It's just fascinating to me how amazing the experience of being here is. Mm-hmm. There's so much to explore, so much to be grateful for.
Yeah.
And to explore, to investigate, which is fun too, isn't it? To me, it's a lot of fun.
Yes.
Every time I learn anything, it's like, oh, wow. Uh-huh. The brain gets happy yeah. automatically. I learned something
yeah.
new. I never knew. And sometimes simple things. Mm-hmm. Okay, so to go back to the topic, I had another question for you that I'm asking in the middle of the conversation. I apologize, but I wanted to ask you still.
Yeah.
So what made you choose this topic, specific topic of childhood sexual abuse and dissociation, structured dissociation?
Yeah, I think that, so I've been in the field for over 20 some years, and I think that every individual, not just that I worked with, but people who I interact with in the world who are even in the field, yeah. that if we look at things from this universal precautions standpoint of every person has experienced trauma. Mm. And I think that I realize that oftentimes, like in working with in substance abuse for many years, that we might almost even, I don't know if the better word is sort of kind of push away yeah. that part of ourself. Yeah. And I think when I started to look at structural dissociation, I started to understand how it has helped, how it helps the body. What is it doing in particular? And when we see that, for example, in substance abuse, it is just a way that the body comes in and says, I'm going to make you a little tired. So I'm going to engage in a substance that is going to help you not feel so much. Mm-hmm. Or maybe the body is really feeling in a depressed state, so I'm going to engage in something that is going to help me feel more alive. Mm. But oftentimes it's just really the idea of it is how people learn how to distance themselves from these traumatic experiences. Right. I want to move away from it so I don't have to feel it so much. Mm. And what we do in this work, I think, is to help individuals see that maybe that part of you that you are leaving behind is the younger child. Yeah. And that child doesn't want to be left behind by you either. Mm. So we help you become connected to that child. Because oftentimes people grow up and they usually tell me things like, nobody has been able to tolerate my anger because anger was always met with a loss of connection or punishment. So usually we say things like, can you tolerate spending just a few more minutes with this child within you? Mm. If we've all been children, there's a child within us. Right. So I help them see these children, see their child within them. And it helps them be able to connect more and not leave these parts of them behind as well.
Ah, how beautiful. Yes, sounds very spiritual to me. I always go back to that as a reference for myself.
Yeah. Yes.
How beautiful, not leaving anything mm-hmm. behind, right? The fact of this idea of unconditional love, unconditional acceptance of oneself. Wow. I love the quote. It's just a saying on your website. You have words. You say, find meaning, find purpose, find yourself. Mm-hmm. So, and I see that this is what you're helping your clients to do, people to do, mm-hmm. to find that, to reconnect with themselves so they can find meaning mm-hmm. and purpose. You know, one day I asked the question here, how do you make sense of suffering? I don't know to who. And then the person said, I don't make sense of suffering. I make meaning out of it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I was like, gosh, that's so great. That's true. I make meaning out of it. Mm-hmm. So I guess the question for you, another question that came to me is how does one know when they have found that sense of meaning? What's the feeling? What does it look like, Marisa? What does one life would look like from that point?
Yeah, it's such a great question because really, if we look at it from a neurobiological sense, it is engaging in dual awareness. Mm-hmm. And dual awareness is almost like, I sort of use this metaphor of like, hey, can we sit on the couch together mm-hmm. in your mind mm-hmm. and observe the child's memories, observe the feelings, observe the movement experiences, the emotional, cognitive experiences, just observing in that. And so helping an individual become so resourced that they can sit alongside me in this metaphorical sort of movie mm-hmm. of sitting beside and observing what the child's experience was or what these different developmental states were. And what are the emotions behind that? What are the memories? What are the beliefs? Oftentimes there are so many different experiences. We have different predictions during these developmental periods. So really sitting alongside that and being able to observe their pain and suffering from then mm. without becoming blended with it in the now. Mm. And that's when we know that we have created a form of integration within ourselves, mm-hmm. a form of integration for what didn't happen or what should have happened mm-hmm. for this younger self or these other younger selves. Yes. And when we're able to do that, then we're able to move throughout the world in a different way. Essentially, we're relearning, as going back to the neurobiological sense of relearning procedural memory. How do we learn these patterns or these habits of being? So that helps us be able to do that. And then we can use that in everyday experiences. Like we're in the supermarket and we get upset. We know that that part of us was just triggered. Yeah. Somebody engaged in an empathic failure. It mm. doesn't mean anything about you. It's just a part remembering mm. that.
Yeah. Wow. That's a beautiful yeah. practice. That's a wonderful one. Mm-hmm. We can really engage. Mm-hmm. And that's, it seems like for a lot of people, that sounds like work. And that's an effort, right? There's effort yeah. behind. And I noticed that some people are not really willing to do the work, even though they know they need healing, they need mm-hmm. to change. At least maybe they don't use the word healing, but they do know that they need to change something. Something has to change. Yeah. So another question that I used to ask here is, that I'll ask you, is there timing when it comes to healing? I wonder why mm. some people are open and they engage in healing, and some people, they just seem to be oblivious or not really interested. Mm-hmm. And they die that way. I do know some people mm-hmm. in my family, they're 85 now, and they still hold yeah. so much. Those traumatic patterns, I can see that clearly.
Yeah.
So yes, why do some people open up to healing and are mm-hmm. willing to do the work, and some people are not? Is there such a thing as being too late, Marisa, when it comes?
No, I never think that there's mm-hmm. any time that's too late, because when I hear that, I often think about what protector is there in front of the room with me. And because often people don't want people to come inside, internally inside, because that's where the abuse often happened, either psychologically or physically. And so it's so important to ensure that nobody comes in and destructively takes advantage of the self. And so I find that when that happens, I have a lot of rapport building to do with these protectors. And I love when they come into the conversation. I love when they come in and have to be angry, even at me, because that there was nobody in their life that could do that. There's nobody in their life that they could run away from. So they might run away from treatment sometimes, but then come back. And I always welcome them with open arms, because these individuals are these, I try to explain to people that these are your own personal bodyguards inside. Yeah. And I'm not going to tell a bodyguard to stop protecting somebody.
Right. Yes.
I'm going to say, how will you allow me to come and be a support? Maybe not today, but maybe another time. And so when you do that, it sort of softens these adaptive strategies to not feel like they have to act like shields.
Right.
Because if we don't acknowledge how they've kept people alive, then they're going to feel left behind as well.
Right. That's so true. Mm-hmm. Wow. What's not to love about it? The work
yes.
you do, it's just beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah, to go Thank through you. To go through the process, because it is a process, and just mm-hmm. and stay there with them. That's just yeah. it's precious. Thank you so much for being you, Marisa.
Got it.
Really beautiful.
Got it.
Gosh, I wrote here some questions, more questions, mm-hmm. but and hopefully we went through most of the outline. So mm-hmm. let me go back just in case. Understanding yeah. the mechanisms of survival. I think we talked about this. Mm-hmm. The impacts of childhood. Sexual abuse. Yeah, you mentioned that too. And then there's one thing that I feel like we didn't talk about mm-hmm. was the challenges and barriers, although you did mention that too. The way to recognize, so recognition is very important to be able to know.
Yeah.
And then you mentioned including some of the, the behaviors would be, you mentioned stigma, self-blame, and difficulties yeah. in seeking help. Mm-hmm. So talk to me for a moment about that. And also the, you mentioned here, societal misconceptions that might hinder support and understanding for survivors.
Yeah. Yeah. So, there are oftentimes, individuals just kind of, I guess, going to the challenges and barriers. There's so much stigma and shame around, what someone experiences, yeah. like mm-hmm. what dissociation is. So oftentimes people will blame themselves. They believe that they should have been able to prevent it or stop it or be able to hide more of themselves so it doesn't get in the way of relationships or work, and mm-hmm. Because people make them feel that way. And so we sort of normalize the symptoms that people experience this, and sometimes they minimize the severity. This is just who I am. And often it's usually because people have this experience of dissociation that it is a thing to get rid of. Right. And dissociation is something that we all experience and will continue to experience the rest of our lives. Mm. What we're doing is just understanding the differences between a part of us that is dissociated in the body and a part that's dissociated in the mind, in the movement. So there's a lot of components around it. And then when I think people realize like, hey, your animals are doing it, your mammals are doing it as well. It really softens the idea of like, oh, I'll continue to do this and it's helpful. It's just how we move away from really challenging things in the body, that our body says, this is too overwhelming. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take you away right now, but just temporarily. Mm-hmm. So there's mm-hmm. a lot of experiences around that. And then just kind of looking also around the societal misconceptions, especially in relation to the particular type of abuse. Mm-hmm. Because while child sexual abuse is also incredibly traumatic, there's a lot of differences between sexual abuse that happens in the family and sexual abuse that happens with siblings as well. And that oftentimes, if people come and consult with me, they'll say things like, well, I don't understand. Why are they with them still? Because they just don't believe that anybody is ever going to think that what happened is what happened. They don't feel like they're going to be believed. They feel like they're going to be stigmatized, or that there's a lot of discomfort in talking about it. People often mistrust children. especially if it's about the family. Oh, they would never do that. That's often the comment that I will hear, that people will say that a caregiver or family member has said to them. And so there's also so much stigma around abuse that happens within the family, and a lot of shame. And shame is felt just like anxiety. And so it could be our shame, and it could be also the shame that they feel from the person who experienced or was the perpetrator as well.
Right. Wow. Yeah, shame is a big one. Actually, yes. Everything's just so, the way you describe what happens and how it happens, is just so sad. That's the word that comes to mind. Yes. Because it feels like there's a lot of fear behind human behavior, right? There's so much stigma, as you said, but I see fear as the foundation. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like the fear of not being human, or this is not human, or escaping something that might feel that's not normal. So there's a lot of it's confusion, really. I would say that's what it is. I love the idea that we can be open, you know, to knowledge, to education of all kind, and conversations. Yes. Just being open to discuss anything. Mm-hmm. That would change, I think, the dynamic of this reality in the way that humans interact. It would really change everything if we could be open. But it doesn't.
Yeah.
Often it doesn't happen. Yeah. So another question that I have for you, because I know we talk about dissociation and the behaviors that behind it, and how it's expressed. So the protectors. And then I guess the question is, what would be justified or normal, natural anger? I wouldn't say rage, though. I think that's can never be justified. But anger. Do you see any situation that the anger could be justified as normal, as natural?
Yes, absolutely. And I wanted to throw in one comment, I think, about the misconceptions. I just realized, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Just to throw in that the biggest fear, and this coincides to the question as well, is disrupting the family's relationship. The relationships within the family, and disrupting the loss of that. Because biologically, we all want to be a part of a tribe. So there's this biological sense that if I tell, then I am going to be excluded from that. Yeah. There's this sort of blueprint within us about that.
Yeah.
So there's that component as well. But like when I think about what might trigger that particular protector part, is anytime anybody increases a level of vulnerability within us, when we see betrayal, unfairness, loss of control, threat, either if it's actual or implied, empathic failures of the younger part of us, or the attached cry, the part of us that really just wants to be loved, and it doesn't matter what that love looks like. And so these protector parts, or the anger, what we might refer to, vehement emotions, are what we might feel when we can't speak. And oftentimes these particular protector parts want to suppress these emotions or these parts of ourselves, like to be submissive again, or to be anxious, or to be speechless again, or to reach out to people just for the sake of love, and not recognizing that those individuals that we see in front of us could also be destructive. So this particular part of us that houses kind of anger wants to make sure that we push all of those away, so we never get disappointed or hurt again. So I think it is so healthy to have anger. Anger is also the place in which we are able to get things done. It motivates us. It helps us move forward in our life as well.
Ah,
So I always encourage it.
Yes. So that's
in every sense.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's great to hear, because that has to do mm-hmm. with feeling the feelings, yeah, not pushing
yes.
anything away.
Yeah.
And, you know, that reminded me of a psychotherapist that is a psychologist that I interviewed from mm-hmm. Canada. And I remember he had this anger. He called it issue. So it was getting in the way of his relationships, his life in general. So he decided to move from Canada to, what's the place? Somewhere, Thailand. Yeah, Thailand.
Uh-huh.
Said, okay, maybe I'll find a place that no one will make me angry. And I'll live this very relaxed life. And then he noticed that it didn't happen. So he was still getting anger, you know, for small mm-hmm. things would make him anger. And then he came to the conclusion, we're talking here, and he said, you know, I really realized that he even got angry at me. So he was always getting angry yeah. at somebody or something. Uh-huh. And then he said, you know, I think I'm addicted to my own emotions. That's what it is. I can't stop them uh-huh. from arising. Uh-huh. So I think that's the conclusion that he made from himself. Mm-hmm. That mm-hmm. anger to that extent of happening too often, it was an addiction. Have you heard it? Have you heard about this, such a thing as being addicted to feelings and emotions, Marisa?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, because that is the familiar space. If we go back even to procedural memory, if we grow up in a home that is abusive and violent, we're used to these states of being. We're used to, let's say, chaos, because we almost become addicted to the endorphins that come alongside that. And oftentimes there isn't any outlet for it. Sometimes children have it in school, but then they might be suppressed there. So then what we talk about is being able to acknowledge, you know, what does it feel like to be happy? Because that is a state of being that has not been able to exist. But before we can look at that, we have to look at what parts of us do we feel the most comfortable in? Because what feels comfortable mm-hmm. is that internal state of distress, because that is the habit our procedural memory reminds us of. We're used to tensing up. We're used to sort of holding ourselves in and being ready mm-hmm. to either run or fight. And to let that go feels so threatening. Mm-hmm. So we often just become, it becomes a part of us that feels a lot more comfortable. So we have to sort of look at that and be able to develop a relationship to those parts that need to be there. Mm-hmm. Who is still there? Yeah, within that.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, it has. Mm-hmm. It's part of my experience too. It's something insightful, kind of to notice that. Uh-huh. The more I remember being trying to run away from the kind of behavior, people who would easily get angry and all that, but then always finding myself around them, and then there was like I was so confused. Why? It's something mm-hmm. that I'm not comfortable with. I don't want mm-hmm. to cause suffering. So, but why am I here next to this person and around him, her? And that has been the case also with my husband. He tends to get angry and I tend mm-hmm. to get, I don't do that anymore, pushing away. Mm-hmm. But I remember getting really worked up in the sense of angry myself. I am getting angry. Yeah. And then just create this huge mess. And the more peaceful, I mean, the more work I do, the more I see that it's mm-hmm. just something that has nothing to do. Let's say his anger has nothing to do with me. He's just something that's mm-hmm. within himself. But then why am I in the situation? Because... Oh, are you okay, mm-hmm. Marisa? Do you want to
call? Oh, yes. Sorry. Just a call.
Yes. Uh-huh. So that's fascinating how, get actually, it's hard to use the word addicted, but it is, isn't it? We get used to certain situations and any mm-hmm. that's a chemical thing that happens in the brain. And then now automatically we are feeling comfortable in a way with something that most people would feel uncomfortable.
Yeah. And It's often about, sorry to step on the word, but trauma reenactment happens unconsciously for us. It is a way of finding, so often people will tell me things like, I find like a similar pattern in relationships. People might express that to me. And what that usually means is there is a part of us that wants to resolve what they weren't able to resolve then. So we unconsciously find what has been missing in our life in order to have more control this time. Even if it doesn't look the same, they're an adult now and they can think about it differently. Versus a child, you're just trapped. There is no outlet often for children.
Right. Wow. So we're just reliving the trauma, the suffering, right, in a way, in a more refined way, but it's still, suffering. Mm-hmm. Well, unnecessarily, from my perspective. So, we're almost at the end. I do want to know, keep going here with you, but because of the time, there's something else we did. The importance of support and then also the treatment and recovery. So you mentioned the importance of trauma-informed care. And then, please talk to me about these two. I know that you offer the treatment would be finding a therapy, but are there different ways of going about treatments for dissociation, Marisa, or trauma, structural dissociation, or therapies?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think the best way that I have found, and I've gone through a lot of different trainings and therapeutic orientations. I started off many years with motivational interviewing, which gave a real good baseline as to really get underneath what is occurring within the individual, to really be able to sit beside the person and to collaborate in that sense. And then I found that there's different components depending on the level of dissociation and how it might move along the process to where it might create more different diagnoses. So sensory motor psychotherapy, I have found to be super helpful in understanding how trauma lives in the body and how it might create somatic experiences in the body. For example, different medical conditions in the body. And how it helps us be able to connect to the way in which we live in our body. Also, the one that I found to be the most helpful in combining sensory motor psychotherapy is the work of Janina Fisher. It's the trauma-informed stabilization treatment. And that is where she has sort of taken different modalities like sensory motor psychotherapy, the structural dissociation model and internal family systems, and then a lot of her own components and put it into one therapeutic process where it helps understand the distinct identity between each part of our personality. And that has been the most helpful, I find, in helping individuals who experience chronic developmental and relational trauma that has been pretty abusive, like maybe cult-type traumas or other traumas that have been really destructive-type traumas. That has been super helpful as well. But it also works for individuals who might not have experienced trauma to understand themselves. So there's a lot of different experiences or therapeutic modalities that have been helpful.
Right. That's wonderful to know. Yeah. I will have your website will be here on the podcast notes. Let me go back. Yes. So it's telushealthandwellness services.com. So I'll have that in a clickable way. I also want to mention your services, substance use therapy, trauma therapy, therapy for chronic pain, and LGBTQIA plus counseling as well. So I have all, I'll have the website here linked.
Great.
Before we say goodbye for today, Marisen, I want to thank you again for your beautiful presence in our reality, for being open to life to this extent of going deeper and investigating the psyche and then, of course, the body. I mean, it's just beautiful work. Thank you so much for being you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Is there anything else that you left unsaid? Anything else that you would like to say before we say goodbye for today?
Well, I guess just to acknowledge that every part of you is welcome and beautiful and accepted, and to really understand each part of yourself, it's so important just to notice yourself and notice any of these parts of yourself coming in and just welcoming them and coming at a place of curiosity. And that sometimes shifts a lot of different experiences within us.
So true. Yes. Yes, a billion times to that.
Yeah.
State of curiosity. Thank you again, Marisen, for your presence. And we'll talk soon. Bye for now.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for listening. To learn more about Marisen Harris and her work, please visit ELOSHealthandWellnessServices.com.
To learn more about this podcast, please visit fitforjoy.org/podcast. Thank you again for listening, and bye for now.